We're beginning our second part in the book of Ruth, and I would like to dedicate today's learning to our good friend David Gabler, David ben Sarah, out in Chutz La'aretz. We miss him, and we await his return. And we're already dedicating to him. We'll dedicate his other half also to Pnina, his wonderful wife. Yeah. No, we're waiting for his return, and we wish him a good Yom Div. We are learning the Megillah of Ruth, and we had an overview last time. We should remember that Ruth was composed by Shmuel at the end of his lifetime, at the end of David's lifetime, after he had appointed David as king of Israel, after he had anointed him. Towards the end of his life, he wrote this work that records where David came from, the lineage, the two generations that preceded David. And part of what we see in this Megillah is how those who give honor to Hashem's name, what they merit. How Eglon, the Moabite king, when he heard he has a message from God, he got up, and then he was assassinated by Ehud, our leader. This was during the period before the Megillah. And our sages point out that when Eglon arose in honor of the message from God, God noted that in heaven, and that's why Eglon merited to have a granddaughter, or great-great-great-granddaughter named Ruth, from whom the Davidic dynasty and the Melech HaMashiach come from. When we read the Megillah, we would do well to note a concept that is the strength of David. Many times in David's life, it seemed like he was down and out. Many times it seemed like it was all over. And the message that David leaves over to his children, his grandchildren, and to us today is Afilu cherev chadam unachat al tzavaro shel adam, even when a sharp sword is placed on one's neck and it's sharp, all that's left is to push it down and it's over. The guillotine is on the neck. Al yimna atzmo min harachamim, a person should not restrain from asking God for mercy. It ain't over till it's over. Even at the last second, things can change. And David never gives up, as much as things seem like they're all stacked against him. And that is why David represents kingship. David represents that ability to persevere, to stand up to the odds. And our Megillah began with Elimelech, a man who claimed he had a right to the throne, and yet he did not, because he did not stand up when things got tough. He went to Chutz La'aretz thinking, I will go lagul b'sdei Moav. I'm going there just to stay a little bit where things are cheaper in Moabite territory. The lush greens of Moab that lies adjacent to the Jordan, the Moabite territory where things were cheap, it was easier to live there. It was a time of famine. And ultimately, vayiyu sham, they remained there. And ultimately, Elimelech died there, as did his children. And only his wife came back when finally she was no longer obligated to him and to her two children.
Why did Hashem didn't kill her?
So she was obligated to her husband. He left the Chutz La'aretz, and he wanted her to come with him. What's she going to do? Say no? She could have said no. She has the power, halachically, a wife can tell her husband, I'm not leaving for Chutz La'aretz. But Naomi chose not to, and she paid a price for it. For not going with him for the fact that she went with him to Chutz La'aretz, she paid a price. She lost her husband, her children, and all her wealth. Now it's interesting that when Elimelech left for Chutz La'aretz, he was a wealthy man. And he thought, if I go to Chutz La'aretz, I'll maintain my wealth. And the exact opposite happened to him. He lost all of his wealth. He lost his life. He lost his children. And those that remained in Israel, they remained. Elimelech goes to Chutz La'aretz. He passes away. His two children marry two princesses, Orpah and Ruth. And Ruth is the daughter of Eglon, the king of Moab. And Mahlon and Chilion, they die. So, now, before they died, the Pasuk tells us that after Elimelech died, what remained was Naomi and her two children. And the Targum stresses that she remained a widow and her two children remained orphans. Now the term orphan in Halacha has specific connotations. We have specific mitzvot towards an orphan. We're supposed to have extra care, extra kindness. We are supposed to go out of our way for the orphan. Now, what happens when a man is 75 years old and his father dies? Are we going to say he's an orphan? Obviously not. He lost his father, but he's not an orphan. The concept of an orphan, a yatom, is one who needs the parent, who is still leaning on the parent when the parent passes away. Meaning, someone who is young that loses the parent, so young that they're no longer standing on their own two feet. Now, when the Pasuk says that when Elimelech died, he left his wife a widow, and his two children orphans, the Pasuk is indicating that the two children, Mahlon and Chilion, were young. Which, in a way, makes it easier to understand that when their father passes away, and they're in Moabite territory, they end up marrying non-Jewish women, the Moabite women. Again, this goes back to the question we raised earlier, how do we view Mahlon and Chilion? Were they princes? Were they leaders, as the Rambam says? Or were they youngsters who erred and married non-Jewish women, the way Pashup Shat seems to indicate?
They were princes, because they're from the house of Yehuda, from Bethlehem.
Okay.
And Bethlehem was one of the cities that princes from Yehuda came, and Hebron and Bethlehem.
So Naomi is out in the Moabite fields, and an angel comes and tells her that Boaz's prayers were answered, that there's a great leader in Israel named Boaz, her relative, and Boaz is really her cousin, and he's also her husband's nephew, meaning she married her uncle. Elimelech is Naomi's uncle, and as such, Boaz, who is Elimelech's nephew, is also Naomi's cousin.
And
his prayers have been answered. An uncle may marry a niece, yes. An aunt may not marry a nephew, but an uncle may marry a niece. So when she's in Moab, the angel tells her that in the merits of Boaz and as answer to his prayer, God has redeemed the Jewish people, God has given them food. The famine has ended. And now she herself, who is in a dire state, arises on Yom Tiv, and the angel has just told her to go back to the land of Israel. So she goes back on Yom Tiv with her two daughters-in-law. And they're going, they go beyond the Tchum Shabbos. We know you're only allowed to walk a certain distance on Shabbos, and it's unclear whether that applies to Yom Tiv as well. If it does apply to Yom Tiv, so then we say that for the sake of settling the land of Israel, there is a certain rabbinic transgression that we were allowed to transgress. Our sages say, if one has the ability to purchase land in Israel, we live in Israel and there's certain land that's owned by non-Jews, and on Shabbos there arises the ability to purchase that land, so then we're permitted to go and get a non-Jew to write up the contract and sign in our name, so as that we attain this land in Israel, even though ordinarily it is rabbinically prohibited to ask a non-Jew to do work for us on Shabbos, for the sake of settling the land of Israel, this transgression was permitted. And so, says the Chatam Sofer, was the prohibition of Tchumin, that we're limited in the distance we can travel, that was also permitted in this case, so that they could come back to live in the land of Israel. They want to become Gerim. And Naomi tells them, go back. You're not going to get a shidduch here. According to one understanding, they didn't yet know that a Moabite woman is allowed to marry into the Jewish people. So she tells them, go back. And she says, may Hashem pay you back for that which you helped me. And as in that merit, you guys should find yourselves a good shidduch. You should get remarried. And you'll find peace in your parents' home. Now, they say, we're going back with you. We want to become Gerim. And she says, no, a second time, go back to your nation. I'm bitter, she tells them. I'm bitter for me. I'm bitter for you. And even though things are so bad for me that my whole life is destroyed, I've lost everything, I'm still bitter for you. And this is the sign of a great person. Most people, when things are going bad for themselves, they cannot see beyond their Dalet Amos, beyond their four footsteps. They can only see themselves. When something's hurting a person, he cannot see beyond himself. A great person is a person that even when things are difficult, he could see the other person's pain. And Ruth, And Naomi, what Naomi is telling them is, "Ki mali me'od mikem, I am bitter for you. If you come here and ruin your lives, you won't get married. What future do you have? Ki atavi yad Hashem, even though the hand of God has come out against me, I still care for you and I still want what's good for you. And logically, there's no reason you should come with me." It's interesting that Naomi also takes responsibility. Everything around her collapsed. She could have said, "My husband invested badly. My children married wrongly. God punished all of them. Now I could go back and be a righteous woman." She doesn't say that. She looks at all the tragedies that befell her family as her own responsibility. She says, "Ki yatzeah vi yad Hashem, God's hand has come out against me." Very often in life, when things go bad, we look at the other ones. My wife's fault. She's the one that's causing this marriage to be destroyed. Yeah, it's very easy in life. It's the first thing we do. We look at the other. It's his fault. Whenever there's a fight, we blame the other. The great person looks at himself and says, "It's my fault." Now, sometimes you'll say, "But logically, the other person does have some fault. I can't lie." The question is, what are we focused on? If in life we will focus on the other's faults, we will never move forward. If in life we will see the difficulties as our own responsibility, the fact that others also have a hand in it, that's their issue, that's not my issue. Naomi says, "God's hand has come out against me." We have a rule in life. Hashem is Hatzur, the Rak Tamim Pa'olo. His actions are whole, are complete. You remember the famous story about the robber that was captured after stealing from many people, and the king said, "Is there anyone that has a good word to say about him before we kill him?" And a child steps forward and says, "I do." So they ask the child, "What do you have to say?" And he says, "It's true, that man is my father, he's a thief. He might deserve to die, but do I deserve to be an orphan?" The child has a claim in God's perspective, but not mankind's perspective. In our perspective, go ask your father, he did it to you. He deserves to be killed. But God doesn't work that way. We say, God is Hatzul, the Rak, Tamim, Paolo, his actions are complete. There are no innocent bystanders. Anyone that gets hurt deserves to get that hurt. There's no such thing as, well, you happen to be in this situation, so you get hurt. No. Even Naomi, who in essence, her husband was the one that said, "Let's go to Chutzlaretz." Her children were the ones that married Moabite women. She too recognizes, God's hand is out against me if I'm hurting. She explains to them logically why they should leave. And Orpah kisses her and turns her back to her. Orpah comes from the word Oref, nape of the neck, back of the neck, because that's what Orpah was good at. She turned her back on people. Our sages say that when Orpah left that night, she went back to Moabite territory where she made herself available for hire. The Moabites said, "We don't want a woman like you in our midst," possibly because she was a princess. And so she went to Philistine territory where ultimately she mothered the four great warriors, among which was Goliath. Goliath, the one who stood and blasphemed towards heaven. So how does a woman who was once so close, she and Ruth were walking down the same path, how does she end up at the opposite end of the spectrum where her son is blaspheming? We have to know that in life, as we grow, we're moving the pendulum in a certain direction. We're pushing, and we're pushing. And sometimes we let go, and the pendulum starts swinging. And then we can start pushing again, our ups and downs. But when we totally let go, then as much as we've pushed the pendulum in one direction, it has the potential of swinging in the other direction. Our sages taught us, Shana upiresh kasheni kulan. One who's learned Torah and then leaves it after he's learned is worse than everyone else. If one has never learned, he's an amaretz, so he's not benefiting the world too much, but he's not destroying too much. But once one has learned, once one has moved that pendulum in one direction, when he chooses to let go, it goes swinging back the other way. Our sages told us throughout our history, those that learned but decided they're letting go and went in the other direction were much worse than the people who were just not learned and weren't performing mitzvot. So Orpah had potential. Arpah had gone a long way. She had cried true tears. She cried once, she cried twice. And because she let out tears from her two eyes twice times two eyes is four, she merited to have four children who were tremendous warriors for the Philistines.
Well, they were bad, of course, but...
They used that power for bad. But Arpah ultimately went away. It's interesting that our sages point out that when Arpah would mate, she also had her back to her mate. Also with the back of her neck, Arpah. And this teaches us something about, on a spiritual level, when one connects, one is given the potential to bring the Shekhinah in our midst. Chazal tell us that the Shekhinah rests between a couple when they're together. That's when they're together face to face. There's a lot of depth to this concept, but we'll leave it for now. Naomi sees that Arpah has left. And when Arpah left, what's really come about is the recognition that all along Arpah was coming not out of a love for the truth, not out of a love for God, but rather out of her love for Naomi. And now that Arpah doesn't about face, the test on Rus goes up one notch. Let's picture Rus. She grew up as a princess. She's not used to hard labor. She grew up with all the amenities of life in the castle. And now she's coming back impoverished to a nation where she may not, as far as she knows, she will not be able to marry anyone, to live a life with a woman who is penniless, who doesn't even have the money to bury her husband and children, her children when they pass away.
But
friend, Arpah, who has come with her, has just turned her back and gone the other way. And now Rus is all alone with Naomi, her mother-in-law. And Naomi says, look, your sister-in-law went back. You should go back too.
Were there sisters? No.
It seems according to one opinion, yes. According to another opinion, no. So Naomi tells her, maybe you're coming because you love me. Well, life will be better for you if you go back. Rus tells her, Al tifgi bi. Don't be adamant. Don't get me upset. Don't tell me to leave you. I don't want to leave this religion. Wherever you go, I go. Wherever you sleep, I sleep. Your nation is my nation. Your God is my God. Rus is adamant that this is the way she wants to go. Sometimes in life, we have moments of strength. The cards can be stacked against us, and we can say, I'm doing this. We could step forward and jump. To an extent, whenever a ger becomes a ger, he's doing that. The question is not on that moment. The question is not even on that half a year or 2 years or 3 years where he's working towards that goal. The question is what happens the day after the mikvah. The question is the perseverance. And that is the strength of Rus, and that is the strength of Naomi. On the one hand, it seems like the strength of Rus is in this moment. In the first chapter, when everything's terrible, and Naomi tells her leave, and Rus says, no, I'm coming. It seems like that takes tremendous strength. And it does. We're not coming to belittle that. But we have to remember in life that the strength is not only standing up to the moment and saying, I will do what's right, which is tremendous strength. We cannot belittle that. Many people fall at that moment. But there's another form of strength that needs to be shown, and that is the strength to continue, the fortitude. And that is the strength that we will see is the strength of Rus, which she implants in her family, which is ultimately the strength of David. Whenever people go through gear here, I always tell them, you should know, it's only beginning to get tough. Whatever you did until now was difficult. But it's going to get much tougher after this. The difficulty is in perseverance. And perseverance is measured in our lifetime. It's measured over a span of time. It's measured even in our children, in the continuum. Perseverance isn't measured in the moment. The fact that a person makes it to gear, congratulations, mazal tov. The question is, where do we go from here? And we're going to see that that is even discussed in our Megillah. The minute that Rus expresses, I am with you, the Pasuk takes a woman who is not Jewish and equates her with a woman who is from the greatest of our nation. The Pasuk says, Vatelachna shtehem, they walk together. The mere fact that she made this decision already elevates her status. We see that God has a special love for Gerim, and that love begins not when they go into mikveh. That love begins when they decide they're going to mikveh. When they make that decision, from that moment, God has a special affinity for Gerim. Naomi comes back to the city. And the way God runs the world is that God prepares the medicine before He brings the illness. So as Ruth and Naomi are approaching the city, God has already arranged it that Boaz is completely lonely. Boaz has had 60 children, 30 sons and 30 daughters, and all of them died in his lifetime. And now, the day that Naomi and Ruth are coming back, Boaz's own wife has passed away. So Boaz is the loneliest man in town. And he is nearing the end of his life. We know, in hindsight, that he had only a few more weeks to live. Now one might think this old man, he's the leader of the Jewish people.
How old is he?
I don't remember. We have to look it up in Shoftim. I don't remember if it says how old he was when he passed away.
But did he have any grandchildren?
Nothing. Because Boaz had a little strand of gava. Something very minuscule, but he had a little bit of pride. And every time he married off a child, there was a man down in the tribe of Dan, whose name was Manoah. And whenever he'd make a party in honor of his child's wedding, he would invite people. And really, Manoah should have been on his list of invitations. But he said, Manoah is like a mule. He has no children. He's never going to invite me back. And so he sort of let it slip his mind. 60 children he married off, and he never invited Manoah. And God held that against him, right? Manoah ultimately had the great Shimshon, the great leader of Israel, and all of Boaz's children passed away in his lifetime.
Like, why? How is it possible?
I don't know. Well, maybe there was a plague. Hashem did it in a natural way. So the whole town has united on this Chol HaMoed Pesach, walking in the funeral procession to bury the leader, Boaz's wife. And as they're walking, in comes Naomi. Now we have to picture who Naomi was. Naomi was a woman who always had servants around her. She was always going out in the latest style, and you'd rarely see her in the streets. If you saw her, it was only because there was a big tararam and a lot of people were all around her, servants and maids. She was the queen. She was like the queen. When she left, she was the ultimate beauty, the ultimate aristocracy. And now she's walking back in rags, skinny from hunger. And the people look, and they see her with this Moabite girl walking near her, and ask, is that Naomi? Now, Naomi might have wanted to slip back, you know, when you come back to town, when you used to be the rich man in town, and now you're the poorest in town, you'd like to slip back into your home. Naomi, as she's walking in, everyone looks at her, and everyone sees her, and everyone asks her, that you, what happened? And everyone started talking, it's because she left for Chutz Laaretz.
Oh,
suddenly everyone understands the ways of Hashem, and everyone said, she left Chutz Laaretz, that's what happens. And Naomi says, don't call me Naomi. Naomi means Naim, pleasant. Call me Mara, bitter, because God has made life bitter for me. God has paid me back for what I've done wrong. I went away, I was even pregnant, I was filled with everything, and God brought me back empty from a husband and children. Notice, Reikam doesn't mean empty. God forbid that a tzaddikus like Naomi would begrudge all the good that God imparts upon her at every living moment. No. When she says, Reikam, I've returned empty, she's saying, I've returned empty from the child I was carrying, the two children I had, my husband, my wealth.
She had miscarried.
She miscarried. Don't call me Naomi. God has testified against me and shown my faults. And this really needs further discussion, why she was allowed to publicly claim that she had faults. We know ordinarily we're not supposed to publicly expound on our faults. So there's an aspect where this was tziduk hadin. She was saying, she was justifying the fact that God did this to her. But that needs expansion. Now, when this happens, we again up the notch of the test on Naomi and on Ruth. They just came back to Israel where the prices are high. They just left Moabite territory where they had connections to their aristocracy. The king was Ruth's father and prices were cheap. They're coming back to a land where the famine has just broken and prices are sky high. And they're supposed to live here and they have no parnasa. How are they going to make it work? And that's why the pasuk stresses that Naomi and Ruth, the Moabite, returned from the fields of Moab. Even though they were returning from the land of plenty, even though they were returning from the land where things would have been easier, they came back and they were happy that they came back. And in spite of all the shame they endured, they felt, if we had to do it all over again, we would. We're back where we belong. And with that, we end what's called the first chapter. We know the great Nachshon ben Aminadab. Nachshon, who led the Jewish people into the sea, into the Yamsuf, he had three children. One was Salmon, and Salmon had a son named Boaz. One was Tov, and one was the father of Naomi, Naomi's father. So, and one was Elimelech, obviously. So, Boaz is Elimelech's nephew. He's also Naomi's uncle, Naomi's cousin. And Boaz is a great sage. And we mentioned earlier, he's all alone. And the pasuk stresses that Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, why don't we go out and collect from the stalks that we're entitled to? We know that when you harvest, so if stalks fall, the poor are entitled to collect them, provided that there are only one or two stalks left. So she's learned. And Naomi and Ruth, being that they're modest people and they have elevated midot, they don't want gifts from anyone. So they don't make it known that they're in need. And Ruth tells her, we're entitled to this. God, that's God's gift to us, that we can take. And the pasuk is stressing that Ruth the Moabite, even though now she's a Jew, she's not a Moabite, but the pasuk is reminding us of her history. This is a princess we're talking about. She's accustomed to having everything given to her on a silver platter, and she says, I'll go out and honor, she's honoring her mother-in-law. You're in a difficult state, you're in depression, you're health, you're old, I'll go out and I'll collect the food. And you, people know you around here. I'm a Moabite, no one knows me. I came from Moab. For you, it's a shame if you go out to collect the stalks. I'll go out. And Naomi blesses her, and she goes. She says specifically, I will go to a person who I find favor in his eyes. Why is that? We have a rule, Al tilcham et lechem ra'ayin. Don't eat bread from someone who's looking at you badly when you're eating it. Sometimes someone's sitting for lunch and he has something delicious to eat and you say, hey, can I have a piece? And he gives it to you, but you know he doesn't want to give it to you. Our sages say, don't eat such food. No, Ruth says, I'll go and collect by someone who I find favor in his eyes, who's happy to let me collect in his field, even though halachically she's entitled to that. The Torah granted her those stalks. She's not taking something from anyone. That's hers. God gave it to the poor. Nonetheless, she says, I'll take it from one who I find favor in his eyes. And God made it that her coincidence was that she ends in the field of Boaz. Interesting, her coincidence, just like Eliezer, when he went to the well, asked God, Hakreina hayom, make it the coincidence that I should bump into the girl I'm supposed to bring back for my master for Yitzchak. So sometimes in life we have miracles that are known, and sometimes there are things that God guides us and makes it look like a coincidence. That's called mikreha. Her coincidence. It's no coincidence, but God made it happen in the form of a coincidence that she ends up in her husband's cousin's field, in Boaz's field. Boaz has just finished Shiva. Boaz comes. He's coming from Beis Lechem. And he comes to his workers who are spending all day dealing with the physical, harvesting the wheat. And he tells them, Hashem imachem, May God be with you in everything you do. May you merit to the level that whatever you do will have spirituality. And they say back to him, thank you for the blessing. They answer him, what do they say? Yivarechecha Hashem. May God bless you with the physical, with in the merit that you're blessing us, that everything physical we do should be spiritual. We bless you back. Yivarechecha Hashem. God should bless you with wealth, with physical wealth. Boaz comes and Boaz sees that there's an unusual thing happening. Either ordinarily women did not even come collecting among the male men who harvested, or he saw the modesty in which Ruth bent down. She bent her knees. She wouldn't bend over to pick things up. She did in accordance with halacha. She'd only pick up the things she was permitted. She'd begin at the end of the field so that when she ended, she'd have the big pile in the beginning of the field. Whatever it was, he saw she's an unusual girl. And the lad tells him, that's the girl, the young Moabite girl, who came back with Naomi from the fields of Moab. She came back and became a ger. And she's been sticking around here all day collecting the fields. You see, she's a swift person. She does things with zrizut. And Boaz calls over Ruth and he tells her, do me a favor, stick around here and do not leave for another nation. We see that as pious and as devoted as Ruth was, Boaz felt she needs chizuk, she needs a shot in the arm. And Boaz tells her, don't leave. Stay with us, stay with the Jews. Sometimes we think, hey, if he's for real, if he's a real ger, if he really means it, of course he'll stay thick and thin. We see not that way. We see that even a person like Ruth needs a shot in the arm. Boaz tells her, stick around, things are going to get better. The difficulty in life's tests are that we never know when they'll get better. If Avram would have known for nearly a century that at the end of that century he would have a child, then the test would have been bearable. If people who are dating for 40, 50 years know that at the end I'll find my Basheret, I'll get married, then we could live with the test. The difficulties of the tests are that we don't know when they will end. And Boaz tells her, don't worry, it's going to get better. Stick around, don't leave our nation. It's difficult to be a ger. It's difficult financially, socially, religiously, emotionally. And Boaz takes all of that in and he strengthens her. And he tells her, you collect. If you're hungry, come eat from our food. If you're thirsty, come drink. And when you eat, dip your bread in the vinegar. That helps in this time of intense heat. And Ruth tells him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you give me this special treatment? I come from a Gentile nation, from the Moabites, who may not marry into the Jewish people. And Boaz tells her, I know the rabbis concluded that a female Moabite may marry into the Jews. And I had prophecy that you are still going to bear kings and prophets because of the kindness that you did with your mother-in-law, that you sustained her after your husband died. You left your nation, you left your religion, you left your parents, you left your nationality, the land you grew up in, and you went to become a ger with a nation, with a nation that you didn't know previously, and that is as bitter as death. No one's saying it's sweet to become a ger. Yes, Judaism is beautiful, but leaving one's parents and leaving one's homeland and leaving everything that's familiar to one and coming to rest among the Jews, when you're used to it, you say, it's beautiful, look at our Shabbos, look at everything we have. Yes, it's beautiful, but it's as bitter as death. And you did all of that, and you'll merit for all of that. She said to him, you're doing kindness with me, for nothing, you don't owe me anything. And Boaz tells her, no, you're the one that did kindness for free. I have a relative named Naomi, you took care of her when you didn't think you'd get anything back for that. I owe you. I should have taken care of Naomi when her husband passed away. You took care of her. She said, you're doing such acts of kindness with me who comes from Moabites. The Moabites are cruel. They didn't do kindness with the Jewish people. Only a few years ago, you guys were passing by, they boycotted you. And he answered her, you are no longer a Moabite. You are one of us. You are my flesh and bones. You are a Jew like me. You left everything you had and you came to this nation, you are not a stranger. I have not done an act of kindness with a stranger. It isn't a kindness for free because I owe you, and you are no stranger. You are one of us. And I cannot repay you for all that you have done, Boaz tells her. Hashem, who is the father of all compassion, he will pay back the kindness that you've done to your mother-in-law, and he will pay you back in the world to come for the fact that you became a gift. What is Ruth telling? She says, I find favor in your eyes, for you have comforted me. You've comforted me about my portion in the world to come. You've comforted me because you've given me the understanding that I can still marry and have a future. And I don't feel like I merit in the world to come, even like one of the maids that are standing around here. Although Boaz has offered her all this food, she shies away. She's modest. And she sits by the side of those harvesting. And Boaz sees that she's not going to eat, so he takes a portion of bread and gives her. He wants to give her meat, and she refuses. She takes what she needs. She eats, she's satiated, and she even leaves over to bring her mother-in-law. And just when she finishes eating, what do most people do when they finish eating? They sit back, they open their belt, just a second, let me take it easy. No! She's Liza. She behaves with alacrity. She gets up right away and continues collecting so that she has what she needs. Boaz tells the guys, hey, she collects in the places she's not supposed to, turn a blind eye. If you can drop things next to her, make believe you forgot, let her have it. Don't worry about it. But Rus is smarter than that. And Rus doesn't take all these free gifts. She collects what she's supposed to collect. And because she's so diligent, at the end of the day, when she's tired, she doesn't leave over the work for home. No, she threshes over there in the field so that when she comes home, she's going to have clean kernels to bring her mother-in-law. Notice the diligence. Notice the perseverance. These are the traits we're supposed to learn from Ruth. And when she measures it, she has a tremendous amount, the amount of 3 se'ah. It's a huge amount of kernels. Ordinarily, a woman can't carry that, but Ruth is a powerful woman, not only spiritually, physically as well. She schleps this huge amount, she brings it home. And when her mother-in-law sees it, and she sees the leftover food she brings, she says, where'd you collect today? Who treated you so nicely? Whoever recognized you, may he be blessed. And she tells him about Boaz, and Naomi tells her we're relatives of his. Blessed is Hashem, whose kindness perseveres for the living and the dead. And Ruth tells her, you know, he said I should stick around with his men. And Naomi says, yes, you should.
Stick with women.
Stick around with his women, right. He told me that go around with my girls. When my girls leave my castle and go around, you go with them. Don't be around with the men harvesting, and that's the way you'll collect it. And that's what she did. And Naomi, and there's an aspect where Naomi saves face here. Naomi tells her, even though you come from kings, you should know that he, the great leader of Israel, is also our relative. We also come from an important family. We're up to the third chapter. Naomi tells her, you know, I swear I won't be able to rest till I know things are good for you. At night there's wind. At night people don't see. It's a time where people don't have so much. Boaz is waiting till the nighttime now to thresh the to winnow. When you take the kernels and you throw them in the air and the chaff blows away, that's called winnowing. So you need a wind for that. At night there's a better breeze. And at night he doesn't want people to see. There are still people who don't have so much. So he's doing it in modesty at night. So she tells him, I want you to wash yourself, go to mikveh so you're pure. In case something happens tonight, you won't cause him to sin. Put on your perfume, wear your beautiful clothing, and go down to the granary. Now, we're talking about an old man who's pious, who's a tzaddik. You'd think, well, you gotta be so beautiful for him? And the answer is yes. Our rabbis told us there were great rabbis whose wives took care to beautify themselves. They said, let's not let them look at anyone else. These were great rabbis that when they prayed for rain, minutes later it started raining. And yet their wives knew they are human. A smart wife invests in her beauty, invests in attracting her husband. She doesn't have to be beautiful for everyone else on the street, but she does have to be beautiful for her husband. The custom at that time was that if one passes away and leaves over a wife, then the relatives should marry that wife. Now, this was a custom. This isn't the halachos of Yibum. There's no halacha that her second cousin, Boaz, her first cousin, is supposed to marry her. But there was such a custom. And it was a custom following the spirit, the idea of Yibum. And in keeping with that custom, Naomi doesn't want Ruth to marry anyone else, and Ruth doesn't want to marry anyone else. And Naomi tells her when he lies down, don't go hugging him the way an immodest woman would, but rather just uncover his feet and lie down next to him in modesty and shame and see how he reacts. Ask him, what am I supposed to do? And he is a wise man, he will tell you. Boaz finishes to eat and drink, bless Hashem, and he starts praying to Hashem. And he has a moment of spiritual elevation, and he speaks to his Creator and thanks that God accepted his prayer and ended the famine. He's standing here with all this plenty. So he's standing there with a special prayer connecting to his Creator. And finishing that prayer, he goes to sleep. The way every person is supposed to go to sleep is out of connection with their Creator, out of learning something, out of prayer, out of saying Shema. And in the middle of the night, he awakens. As he's turning over, he bumps into someone, and he's scared. Who's there? And he feels there's a woman. And he gets goosebumps.
Oh my.
And he's human. And like anyone else, he wants to do something. Oh. And he takes a vow and says, I'm not doing anything. Who is this? He asks. And the girl says, it's Rus, your maid. I want you to spread your wing over me. You're responsible for marrying me. And your name should really be called on me. You should marry me. And Boaz recognizes that here we have a young girl. According to some opinions, she was about 15 at this time. He's an old man, maybe in his 70s. And he tells her, your last act of kindness, that you waited around to maintain this custom, is even greater than your first act, that you became a ger. Sometimes it's harder to keep customs than it is to keep the whole thing. And Boaz tells her, this last act was even greater than your first act. But I also want to keep the custom. And in accordance with the custom, you have an uncle who's closer than me, your cousin. There's an uncle to your husband named Tov. He's a closer relative than I, and he has first rights to marry you. Sleep tonight. You don't have to walk back in the dark. And I swear, I am not touching you tonight. He swears. Why does he swear? Because he knows that even though this minute he can contend with his Yetzer, in the next minute that can change. So he takes a vow. And for righteous people, a vow is weighty. For us, I don't know that the vow would make any difference. But for a person on Boaz's level, once he takes a vow, now he knows he's not going to sin. So he takes a vow, I'm not touching you, but I swear tomorrow we will resolve the issue and you will be wed either to him or to me. She gets up early in the morning. He doesn't want people to know that there's been a woman around. You know, don't want to give people room to talk. And he gives her, in her kerchief, 6 stalks of barley, and that's an allusion to the 6 great people that would come out of her. The 6 great people, our sages say, are Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the Mashiach, David, 6 great people, and each one was blessed with 6 things: Chochma, Bina, Eitzo, Gvura, Das, Yiras Hashem. And that's the allusion he's giving her with these 6 stalks. And she goes home to her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law tells her, stick around, let's see how things come out. Boaz promised you he's taking care of it today. Today it's going to be taken care of. And Boaz tells her, don't think I'm pushing her off. That night he tells her, don't think I'm pushing you off. Boaz tells her a line here, and when I read this I was shivering. Boaz tells her, everyone knows, the whole Sanhedrin knows, that you're a righteous woman, and you have the strength to carry the yoke of the mitzvahs of Hashem. Meaning, she's lived up to all the tests till today. The woman has lived up to the test of being poor, losing her honor, being disgraced, walking around collecting the charity of the Leket Shekhan Teah, being with her mother-in-law, thinking she cannot be wed. She's lived up to all these tests. And Boaz tells her, but the reason I can marry you is because I know your perseverance. I know you will hold out in the future. You've held out until now. But it's only because we see your strength and we know you will hold out in the future. a ger always has to contend with the difficulty that this isn't second nature like everyone else. It's a difficulty. It's a challenge. And as much as a person tries to shove it under the rug, there's an aspect where a person has to contend with it. When things get tough, it's tougher for a ger. Much tougher. And a ger has to know that he has to be strong. He has to be like Rose. He has to learn from Rose. And that's what Boaz tells her. I will marry you because I know you have the strength. You will persevere. That is the strength of Rus, and that is the strength of David. Boaz tells her, don't worry. You might think I'm not going to marry you tomorrow. You don't have yichus. Well, you have the best yichus. Some people have yichus. They come from great genealogy. They have a great family tree. Yichus is the genealogy. When a person has a great father or a great grandfather who's very pious, that's called yichus. Boaz tells her, you have even better yichus. You're the father of yichus. You have the ultimate yichus. What does yichus tell us? He has great potential for doing great things because his predecessors did great things. There's good reason to think he will. Well, you, Rus, Boaz tells her, you have done great things. That is the greatest yichus. All other yichus is potential. Your yichus is action. You've done the great things. And do not worry that I won't marry you. Everyone knows you're an Eishes Chayil. And it is most fitting that I, the leader of the Jewish people, will marry you. But we have to keep with the custom and check whether the other relative wants to claim his right to marry you. It's interesting that Boaz gave her these six stalks. Boaz was telling her, you will bear fruit to the Messiah. You will bear fruit to King David. We think when we read the genealogy at the end of the Megillah, yeah, David comes from Boaz. And it's a nice thought that he comes from Ruth. In our Megillah, Boaz reveals to us that the opposite is true. David was predestined to come from Ruth. The question was, who would merit to be her husband? But she was going to have David HaMelech. And that's what Boaz is telling her. I'm giving you these six stalks. I don't know who you're going to be married to at the end of the day. Either me or him. But I do know that from you will come the kingship of Israel. From you, Rus. That is defined in heavens. Who's going to be your husband? That we don't know yet. Will I merit? Will he merit? Sometimes we think, it's because of me. I have great children. It's because of me, right? That's what our sages tell us. That when Rebekah sent Jacob in, she said, if your father discovers that you've been tricking him, alayki l'ilascha b'ni. Whenever you guys misbehave, so what's your father going to say? Yeah, it's because your mother's family. You guys have... That's what Rebecca said. Alayki l'ilascha b'ni. I know if your father catches you, you're tricking him, he's going to blame me. He'll curse me, not you. Don't worry about it. He's going to say, it's the Lavan blood in you. It's your mother's blood. But Boaz is not that way. Boaz says, I know that greatness is coming from you, Rus. And the only question is, who's going to merit to be your husband? Ruth comes home, she's a happy woman. And her mother-in-law tells her, sit around and we'll see. Boaz goes up to the gates where the high court sit, and he's waiting there with the elders, and then that relative, Tov, passes by, and Boaz tells him, sit here, we have to discuss something that is ploni almoni. Something that is covered, something that has to do with an almana, with a widow. So the man thinks, okay, there must be a covered up case with a widow. I got to sit down and help him in ruling this case. Boaz doesn't want to embarrass the person. All the elders are sitting there. This person might say, I'm not marrying her. He's not fulfilling the mitzvah of Yibum. He doesn't want to embarrass him. So Boaz takes aside 10 elders and he tells them, look, there's a field that's being sold by Naomi. Naomi's impoverished. She couldn't plant this field, right? They just came back a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, they came back from Moabite territory. They have a field that's been laying fallow. That's why they have to go collecting other people's field. And they're so impoverished that Naomi now is forced to sell her field. And our custom is that the relative purchase it and you have first rights. Do you want to purchase it? And he says, I will. And then Boaz tells him, well, what about Rus? When you're purchasing that, you're also purchasing the rights to marry Rus. Rus wants to be wed. And according to the custom, you also have first rights to marry her. And Tov says, I cannot do that. I have a wife. I don't have permission to marry a second wife. If I bring her into my home, who knows what fights will be in my home. I might destroy my home. You have no wife. You're the one that's fitting to marry her. And Boaz says, fine, if that's what you want, we'll cut a deal. He takes off his right glove, and they make an exchange. They make a deal of chalipin. When you give someone else, he says, you will accept this glove, and in exchange for that, you give me the rights. Everyone's witnesses to that. And Boaz attains the right to marry Ruth. The elders who are present, everyone present, blesses him, and they tell him, may the woman coming into your home be like Rachel and Leah, that they too built the house of Israel. Va'ase chayil be'efrata ukrashim be'vit lachim. They blessed him that he should be successful. They blessed him because they recognized that his marriage to her was a marriage l'shem shamayim. He was marrying her because he really, really wanted the merit of having a child in the name of Mahlon. Now, even though the custom was to marry the widow, that a relative marry her, the custom did not go so far as saying that the first child would be considered the offspring of the brother. Meaning, when you have Yibum, when a woman's husband dies without children, and the brother marries that widow, so then we say the first child he has is really the spirit coming back of the deceased. But when it's a distant relative like Boaz, there's no obligation to align the first child with his original father. And yet Boaz says, no, the whole purpose of my marrying her is to maintain the name of the deceased, to keep the name alive. And so we will call the field of the wife of Mahlon, and the child will be known as the child of Mahlon. But here it wasn't Yibum. Here it was a custom. He wasn't a brother. Where does Boaz come from? He comes from Peretz. You remember where Peretz comes from? Yehuda had a child named Er. Er married Tamar, and they didn't have children, and he died. Onan did not want to have children with Tamar, because he said, the child I have from Tamar will be named after Er. He's considered Er's continuum. So Onan would sin. He would not really have any potential of procreating when he was with his wife. He would ensure that she couldn't have children. And so he died. And then Tamar tricked Yehuda, and Yehuda lived with her, not knowing it was her, and from that union came out Peretz. And Peretz is really the continuum of Er, who passed away. So the whole genealogy of the people of Beis Lechem, this tribe of Yehuda, it all goes back to Peretz, who came from a situation that a man died without leaving off children, and was married by a relative who brought forward Peretz. And so the people bless Boaz and they say, your house should be like the house of Peretz. Just as Peretz, we are all coming from Peretz, who was an offspring who came from a union that was l'shem shamayim, in the continuing of the name of the deceased, so to you who are building the house of the deceased, of Mahlon, your children should flourish like the house of Peretz. They blessed him that, being that he's marrying her for the sake of heaven, he should have children like Rachel and Leah, that they built the house of Israel, children in quality, children in numbers, children in wisdom, and children with good traits. Boaz is a widower, and she's a widow. Chazal tell us that when a widower marries a woman, so you have three people's thoughts and beds, because he's still thinking of his first wife. And when a widow marries a widower, so then you have four people in bed. Says, even though she's with him, in her mind she has her first husband too. Even though he's with her, in his mind he has his first wife. So Chazal say, arba deot bamita. You have four thoughts in bed. She's thinking of him, she's also thinking of the other guy. He's thinking of her, he's also thinking of the other guy. So Chazal tell us. But here the pasuk stresses, in spite of their history, because they were so devoted to Hashem and they saw such purpose in their marriage, and even though he was an old man and he was wealthy and she was a Moabite and she was young and she was impoverished at this point, their union was strong. They overcame all the differences, the social differences, the differences of their background. Wasn't easy, but no, because there was goodwill. So they overcame all of that. And he was happy with her and she was happy with him. The pasuk describes her becoming pregnant like the pregnancy of the matriarchs, that God gave her pregnancy. It was a special hashgacha, because it was a special gift to Boaz, because Boaz did tshuva. Boaz initially lost his first 60 children because he had that little strand of pride. And he spent time perfecting himself, and now he merited to have a child from this woman. And that child was known as Oved, the servant of Hashem. Notice the term Oved means server, as in constant, as in the power of Rus, who was constant, who persevered, as in the power of David. And then he had the son named Yishai. Yishai comes from the word Yesh, extent, the one who is existent, the one who perseveres, because Yishai should have remained living for eternity. He didn't sin a sin that was worth dying for. He only died because God decreed people should die. So Yishai, his whole name indicates extent, existing, because he should have continued existing. And then we come to David, who is Dod, who is the beloved, who is Gematria Yad, who is the one that he is the symbol of perseverance, of standing up to the tests of life. When they have that first child, so Naomi takes that child. I'm going to tell you something I want you to remember 25 years from now, when your grandparents, God willing. The pasuk stresses that Naomi took him in an unusual way. Ordinarily, when grandparents take a child, they take him after the parent has fed him and changed his diaper, and they say, come, let's play with him. They enjoy him a little bit, and then they give him back to the parents because he's tired and someone has to put him to sleep because he needs a diaper change, because he needs to be fed. That's how grandparents often take the grandchildren. Naomi, the pasuk says, was an omenit. So to speak, she adopted the child. She took him and she put him to sleep at night when he needed to sleep. She mamash took him like a surrogate mother. She saw him as her continuum. And the woman blessed Naomi and they said, he will give you back life. That child will take you out of your depression. That child, when you become old, he's going to support you if you need financial help, because you have a daughter-in-law that's better than many, many children. That's Rus. And the neighbors gave this child the nickname Ben Naomi, and they also called him Oved Hashem. And being that they blessed him that he should be a famous person in Israel in piety and being a servant of Hashem, their blessing came true. And this is an important point to remember, that the blessing of the common folk is worth something. Our sages tell us that at a bris, when people bless the child, tizkul gadlo letorah ulchupal masim tovim, the Medrash says that there was a child that was about to die after a circumcision, and because everyone blessed him, that blessing, so the angel of death made an about face, he couldn't touch the child. Even common folk, their blessing is worth something. So our Megillah ends with the continuum all the way till David HaMelech. The Megillah teaches us the importance of kindness even to a mother-in-law, kindness that transcends the boundaries of nationalities, that transcends ages, familial differences, social differences, economic differences, the kindness of Rus to Naomi, the kindness of Boaz to Rus. May Hashem bless us that we should all merit to attain this level of kindness, to appreciate Eretz Yisrael that we're living in. The Megillah begins with the importance of Eretz Yisrael, and to appreciate the potential we have and live up to the message of Rus, the message of perseverance and fulfilling our potential. Chag Sameach.
It was brilliant lesson, really. And it could be delicious.